Welcome to the Dildorks, dorky discourse on sex, dating, and masturbating. My name is Kate Sloan. I'm a sex journalist, a sex blogger, and I have dozens upon dozens of sex stories that I love to tell. You might have noticed if you listen to this show. Who are you, friend?
I'm Bex. I'm a sex educator and a sex blogger, and I love being the center of attention with stories.
Oh, really?
I know,
never
right?
Would have guessed.
Put me on stage and I'm like, hi, look at me, let's talk about butts.
We have a super special guest with us today. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Clary H. I am a queer matchmaker, storytelling, live event host slash podcaster. I'm a sexuality oriented radio host, and I do occasionally teach about sex and dating, and disability is kind of part of that now too.
You do a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
So I was first introduced to you because I was going to your event, Tell Me Something Good, which still is like maybe my favorite event that I go to on the regs. It's a sexy storytelling event, and it's so much fun. It's such a supportive environment. I tell a story every month if I can.
I came to Toronto this trip to go to Tell Me Something Good.
So. And you got to judge, which was awesome.
It was so fun.
Can you tell us about like how that event got started?
So I will say, and I hope this isn't a secret to anybody, especially people who live in other cities, this isn't like a unique idea. The having a sex-oriented storytelling night is, you know, it's around. So I was in LA for XBiz in 2014. Yeah, so like January 2014. And I went to Dixie De La Tour's storytelling night.
I love Body so much.
So, yeah. Body storytelling? Is that what it's called? Yes. Body storytelling is a really interesting night. Hilarious. Kind of a different format from us, but really enjoyable. And so I went and I liked it. And I messaged Dixie and was like, hey, is it okay if we do one of these in Toronto? Not knowing that they kind of existed in a lot of cities. Mm-hmm. And then I posted a thing on Facebook just saying like, hey, if I did a storytelling night in Toronto, would anybody come? And a lot of people said yes. And one of my friends at the time was doing booking at the Beaver, which is a queer bar in Toronto. And then somebody who I knew through like the sex positive world but didn't actually know super well, Samantha Fraser, was like, hey, do you need a co-host? And I was like, that sounds like a fun idea. Sure. And so within a couple of weeks we put together this thing, and we called it Tell Me Something Good just because I honestly think that song was stuck in my head at the time. I was like, what about this? And the Beaver, I want to make a beaver pun. It was very tight, I will say. It was full. We had a wonderful first storytelling night. We had, at that point, we were doing like 3 guest judges a night, which is the wonderful thing about Toronto is there are quite a number of sex-positive people doing cool stuff. Mm-hmm. The difficult thing about Toronto is that number is not infinite. So as we were like 3... Also, it takes up a lot more time to have 3 people weigh in after each story and 3 people tell stories. So we eventually brought it back to 1 person. But it was so full that we had people sitting on radiators, which because it was February, were on and hot and like... If you want to sit on that, if that's like your kink to kind of like get a little butt burn, do it up. But we didn't want to force that. So we moved a couple doors down to the Gladstone Hotel, and we were there for a couple of years. And so it's just kind of grown since then. We start off the night just kind of reminding people not to be jerks, to not engage in, you know, sexism, ageism, ableism, transphobia, homophobia, fat shaming, slut shaming, kink shaming, all of that. We try. So far we've been very lucky. And then Samantha and I kind of explain how it goes down, which is kind of like we stick around 5 minutes. People, it's not a curated show, so Samantha and I usually prepare something and the judge often prepares something, but then we just have papers and pens strewn around and people can give us their names, and we usually pick about somewhere in the 10 to 12 range, and we have little themes. This past, actually this last night, was Butt Stuff 4, because Butt Stuff is really the only one that we do every year, because people are fascinated with butts and their relating stuff.
As they should be.
Yeah.
They're so good.
They're so good, and then we just have people tell stories that range from, like, sexy to, we have a lot of kind of, like, awkward, embarrassing, like, could have been in, like, YM magazine kind of stories. And then we also have some touching stories, whether they're kind of, like, confessional or whether they deal with, like, coming to terms with and accepting their bodies or, you know, their sexuality or their kink or something in their relationship. So there's a lot of, like, I mean, I've cried a number of times from stories, and we have people come up on stage and bare their souls. And we also have people tell, like, fart things, which is great, too. So it's a cathartic environment where people can kind of feel free to just talk in a space where people are really receptive, where there's, you know, a lot of applause, a lot of encouragement. And then Come As You Are sponsors us, so we have prizes to give away to our top storytellers.
Yeah, we won some porn last night. Sweet. I was pretty stoked about that.
And we would have a good variety of porn, which I like. And we kind of, like, we'll pick, we have a little, like, suitcase that we roll in every month with different items. We'll kind of curate a selection for, like, okay, some people may be into this, and some people might want more of this. So it's good. It's exciting.
Yeah, I love TMSG, because I feel like no matter what my story is about, whether it's sad or funny, like you were saying, like, the audience is always so supportive, and, like, sometimes I just want to, like, pour my heart out to talk about something stressful that happened, and other times I'm just like, I have this goofy story. Last night I talked about my former coworker, who's now a fuck buddy of mine, who's, like, not good at spanking me, and it was good to, like, have an audience commiserate with, like, how frustrating it is to be spanked for 45 seconds before someone's like, no, my hand hurts.
Can we talk about how you told the story and then sat down and tried to get him to spank you immediately after and he wouldn't come over?
I was thinking about
That's
it.
That's hilarious.
Oh, no.
He was saying that he should come to the event, and I was joking, except not joking. I was like, I will tell a story about you. And he was like, what story? And I was like, well, that story about you spanking me. And he was like, don't tell that one. And I had just told it when I received the text.
Well, I mean, I will say it's anonymous, and we get kind of a little complicated sometimes when we talk about stuff like the ethics around telling stories about people who aren't necessarily there and who are not always portrayed in the best lights. Mm-hmm. Like, we avoid things like transphobia and racism and homophobia and slut shaming, but we don't avoid things like they were really bad at spanking me and they talked a good game but couldn't back it up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, sometimes people use fake names, sometimes people are with the people who they're telling stories about, or they're, you know, ongoing friends or partners who they get consent from. Sometimes it's just, I went on this Tinder date and I met this person and they were like this. So we tend to avoid anything very obvious. And
this is their Facebook name and their Twitter handle when you want to flame them.
We want to balance catharsis with, like, anonymity. And I think it's hard to ever have a perfectly safe space in a sex-positive space. I mean, even just, we got a really, really helpful message last night saying that since we've moved, we're now at Glad Day Bookshop, which is a, you know, LGBTQ bookstore, cafe, restaurant, party venue, you know, like, event space. It's just great. But we had the reminder that, hey, there's actually, now that we're in a smaller space, it's more intimate, and so we do content notes beforehand, but if we give a content note, there's no accessible place to go within the venue where people can get far enough away from the microphone so they can't hear it. And so now we're like, okay, we need to balance, like, some folks in our audience who like it a little bit louder for hearing reasons versus people who need to get away. So I'm going to go scout the neighborhood to look for maybe a friendly space on that block that's accessible and would allow people to come in for a minute. Like, there's the accessible washroom, but the problem is that's also an accessible washroom, and someone might need it for the washroom purposes during a time when somebody wants to get away. So we're always kind of developing new ways to be sensitive, and it's not perfect, and I don't think that sexuality-oriented spaces can ever be totally 100% great at everything related to being safer.
I was curious if you have like favorite stories that you've told? Because like I definitely have stories that like I've told like 500 times and that I think are hilarious. I was wondering if you have like classics.
Oh god. Well, I mean, I have my one classic that I it's that the first story I ever told to tell me something good. And when I do any sort of interview about tell me something good, it's the one I tell. It's also the one that needs the biggest content warning, okay. Which is blood and hospitals and accidental genital mutilation and braces. Oh, no. And I guess blowjobs. So, I mean, so here's the issue with the content notes is they are so valuable and important and almost always spoil the stories.
Yes.
So it's sometimes it's like a fun little dance that you get, because really from that content note you can create a pretty clear story. Basically, I was dating somebody, I had braces at the time, we were very much in love and continue to be in love after, which is great, because in the spirit of being like a good gung-ho partner, I was giving him a blowjob, and I was trying to do a very nice thing, but due to the fact that I had braces, it became a very not nice thing. Aww. Blood everywhere. Ooh. Hilarious, frantic me running around, finally getting cell reception, because this was in a time when cell reception was more precarious. So I was like crouching near a window that did not yet have curtains because he had just moved into a new place, covered in blood, trying to get a hold of 911. And then a hilarious ambulance ride where someone was like trying to keep him alert and awake and saying like, what do you do for a living? And he's a headhunter, but I'm and then yikes. In the hospital there was a mix-up where for a really long time he was just waiting there with like a towel covered in blood like in his crotch, while they were like, someone came up like after I want to say 20 minutes and was like, hey, so you snapped your frenulum, and he was like, yes. And turns out hitting under your tongue, the thing under your tongue, is like the little ligament or whatever, it's also called a frenulum. And they were like, someone was licking a popsicle too enthusiastically. And
would
no.
not know.
I mean, that's, oh god, true also. But yeah, it was that was an awkward mishap. And then once we got in, they kept referring to it as a human bite in the context of like, well, a human bite is actually worse than a dog bite because of the bacteria in her mouth. And I'm like weeping. I'm like, I didn't bite him. This was a long time ago. Now I think maybe I would have held it with a little more grace, but maybe not. And then there was a moment where there was like down the hall, there was sort of a almost like an eyewash station for your junk. And I just heard the blood-curdling screams down the hall. Aww. And then, and this is in hindsight also a content warning for like implied racism, the doctor said when we asked kind of like about the prognosis, he said the South will rise again, which is a really tasteless joke. What? For this situation. And I was like a little too young to understand, but like as I've gotten older, I've been like, wow, that's a messed up thing to say.
It's so unnecessary.
I know. And like he thought he was being funny, so it was just like the icing on the shit cake that day was like a little sprinkle of racism. Yeah. So anyways, that's, I guess, my favorite story. We're still friends. We hang out once in a while. We dated for, like, over a year, and and everything is fine, and it all worked out in the end, but oof. That was not a good day. Nor was it a good subsequent weeks where it was like, you cannot get aroused. And it was like, it was kind of like if there was like a sort of DS control, but we were both being controlled, and the dominant was like biology. So we were both just sitting there watching a lot of hockey.
That's so frustrating. Yeah. And so sad.
And it was like over my birthday and Valentine's Day too, so I just remember being like, okay, well that's, you know, this is fine. This is fine.
I feel like going to Tell Me Something Good has made me more confident just, like, as a sexual person, in part because, like, when you hear all these stories, you're like, oh, awkward shit happens to everybody. Like, it's not just, like, this private thing that, like, just happens to me that I have to be, like, quietly embarrassed about.
Yeah, and it's almost, like, not to say that you need to get into wacky predicaments to come to Tell Me Something Good, but it almost, yes, but it almost, like, it's the nice little, you know, silver lining to whatever awkward, crappy thing that happened to you that month is like, well, you know, you probably tell this to someone, tell me something good. And mm-hmm. that's fine.
Yeah.
There are so many times where I'm, like, feeling anxious about something and I'm like, well, shit, if it goes wrong, I'm gonna have a hell of a story.
That's true. Life is just about collecting stories. And, like, I listen to storytelling podcasts and sometimes I go to non-sex storytelling nights. And mm-hmm. it's, like, it's cool to hear these stories and really these themes that occur universally in stories in other ways. But there is something about sex because it's maybe a little more private, a little more personal, a little less likely to be discussed. And, I mean, we're coming from different places. You all talk about sex. Some might say you do that on your podcast. But there are a lot of people who come who are like, yeah, like, I don't really have any friends to talk to about this. This isn't what my circle's like. Mm-hmm. Or people who are coming for the first time. And it's really nice, whether they tell a story or whether they sit in the audience, to just see them kind of open up and unlock some things. And a lot of it comes down to contending with shame and mm-hmm. kind of dealing with it through cathartic storytelling.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you've told a lot of, I guess, cathartic stories about is, like, you had a stroke and, like, that has changed your sex life a lot. If you're comfortable sharing about that, I'm interested in hearing about that.
I am. So I kind of, like, over the past couple months, I've tried to avoid it because I realized I had the stroke, like, 2 years and change ago, and almost every month I tell a story where I'm like, for those of you who don't know, I had a stroke. And I think it's really valuable to talk about because as much as, like, sex in general is not discussed, disability is also not discussed, and sex and disability is really not discussed. There are some notable, wonderful people who are doing it. One of our friends of the show, frequent judge, frequent attendee, Andrew Gerza, does a great job of that. And so I was lucky in that Toronto has maybe a slightly higher than average sex and disability quotient. Mm-hmm. There are more people talking about it. There's, you know, it's not around as its current iteration anymore, but there was the Rose Center for Love, Sex, and Disability, which is Tim and Natalie Rose, and they're wonderful people who I've become a lot closer to since the stroke, especially because Natalie and I collaborated. We'll talk about that a little later. But yeah, it's my stroke was caused by a vertebral artery dissection, which is a little artery in your neck, kind of like going up to your brain, which is the problem. And I don't, to this day, I don't know exactly what caused it, but based on everything I've discussed and based on, like, not having any traumatic injury, not having any sort of, like, health indications that I would have a predisposition to this, it seems like it was actually dancing or yoga. Because I used to be a burlesque dancer, and that week was actually, like, the busiest week of my life because I had, within the next month, 4 completely different acts that I was working on. So, aside from, like, using a lot of E6000 and, like, putting on individual crystals and just, like, staying up all night stabbing myself in the finger with, you know, needles while trying to sew on fringe, I was also just dancing quite a lot, and nothing was hyperextendy. I've always been pretty careful about my body, which is why it's such an extra huge bummer. But something I did, I maybe flipped my head the wrong way or I turned my neck a little too hard, caused a little nick, and I had a first stroke 10 days prior to my second and third, like, big ol' strokes, where the only thing was that I got so dizzy that I'd finished dinner and I went to the kitchen. I was in the kitchen and I started walking to the bedroom and I sat in, like, the office, and that's not really a thing. And I was, like, just sitting there blankly, and my partner, now husband, came in and was like, hey friend, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, I'm just really dizzy. And, you know, he helped me into bed and got me a compress, and it was really nice because, you know, when you're dizzy, you tell yourself often, it's because I didn't eat enough, or because, you know, I've been overexerting myself, or I haven't been sleeping right. You blame yourself, and also you rationalize. Mm-hmm. And that was actually a stroke. And so it impacted just a part of my brain where I didn't have much in the way of physiological changes, but I kind of blacked out at random points mm-hmm. in the week. So not like pass out, but I would just not create memories at that time. Mm-hmm. And the most notable one was the night before the stroke. It was the Best Sex Writing 2015 launch, and I was doing burlesque, and I was actually there with Andrew Gerza, and you always know that burlesque went pretty okay if your clothes aren't on at the end. So that's true. But I went on stage, and then I had no idea what happened. And the song played, and I wasn't wearing the clothes in a correct way, but I just didn't make a memory of that time. And I got off stage, and I was like, huh, maybe I was just, like, really nervous, and I didn't know about it, or whatever. And there were other periods of the week where that happened. And then I was with Andrew after, and we were kind of talking about sex and disability, and I remember this part saying, like, I'm really, like, I'd love to kind of talk to you about it and see, like, ways that we can maybe collaborate, or I can help, like, you know, get your message out there. I just don't feel like it's really my place. Mm-hmm. And then 6 hours later, it super became my place. Because I had two strokes in the morning. My partner was going off on a business trip, and so he left super early to go to work before going to the airport, and I was like, bye honey, whatever. And then I had a couple hours before work started, so I went to the washroom, and then I was walking back, and all of a sudden I couldn't walk straight, and I felt just really dizzy and weird. And so that was the second stroke. And then I was kind of like, I did a very, don't do this. I went back into bed and I lay down and I rationalized. And I was like, well, maybe this is like an inner ear thing. Or maybe I'm just having like a weird drop in, you know, blood sugar or whatever. Or maybe mm-hmm. I'm sick. And I was sick in a way, in that I had already had two strokes. Mm-hmm. And then I had a third stroke. And at that point, one of my notable... Before that, I actually had to, like, almost crawl to my desktop computer, because I did not have a cell phone at the time, because I had broken it, and I was like, I love the freedom of not having a cell phone. It's really great until you need to call 911. So I actually called my parents, and nobody's expecting a call from me at 6 o'clock in the morning, because I do not believe in that time. And so I called them, and they were like, hey buddy, what's up? And I was like, something is really, really, really wrong. Someone needs to come over. I still wasn't at the point where I was like, 911 is the option, but I was like, something is really wrong. And then I just sat there, and the third stroke hit, and I was like vomiting profusely, and just like completely, I couldn't feel parts of my body, and everything was just very, very wrong. So luckily, they got in touch with my fiancé because I had just moved there. They didn't have a key yet. And everybody kind of like came into the door and was like, what's going on? They called 911 really quickly. And luckily, I live just down the street from the Regional Stroke Center. And so very quickly, they were able to be like, this seems to be a stroke, but it doesn't seem to be like from the test that it was like anything to do with, you know, blood pressure or, you know, more traditional ways of having a stroke. It didn't seem like a hemorrhage. So they were like, okay, let's not give her the clot busting drugs, which would have also busted my aorta or whatever, you know. All the parts of me that were in the process of busting would have been further busted, because it's really good for certain types of strokes and the exact opposite of what you should do for other types of strokes. Mm. So you have to kind of weigh your options. So I spent like a week and a half in the hospital, and then I got transferred for about a month and a half to a rehab facility, and that's, I had to relearn how to like not only walk but stand. I had to learn how to stand because my balance is really impacted. I used to have a lot of weakness on my right side. Now that's pretty much resolved. I remember my day in physio where I started talking with both of my hands because I am a very handsy talker. and I was like, oh my God, that's like my milestone. Not like she can walk again, but like she can gesticulate. And so, yeah, I was in a wheelchair, and then I had a walker, and that was a few months, and I got to a cane, which is what I'm using now. My bummer symptoms include one of my vocal cords doesn't work anymore, which is pretty okay for radio and podcasting. I had a very, very gentle, soft voice initially, which didn't carry at all. And I did some speech-language pathology and some vocal therapy, and it got to a pretty okay place. But my first degree was in opera, and I can't sing anymore, so that's kind of a bummer. Oh, burlesque, everyone's like, someday you can be, you know, you can be like the burlesque person with a cane, or when I was in a wheelchair, they're like, you can do wheelchair burlesque, and I'm like, yes, I can do that. But I'm not really sure I want to be anybody's, like, inspiration porn, in a more literal sense. And also, the burlesque I was doing before was really physical, and really, like, based on tricks and stuff like that, so I could do that, but I'd have to completely reorient, like, what I did. I wouldn't be able to use any of my own acts or my old acts. So it was kind of complicated. And then the most pertinent to sex, aside from I just have, like, constant post-stroke fatigue, is that I can't feel large percentages of my body. About half. About 50, slightly over 50% of my body. Because I have the right side of my face and my hand are, like, I would say two-thirds of the way numb, and then from the neck down on my left side, pretty much nothing. So it's not the most fun.
Yeah, I remember talking to you when I was interviewing you for a piece I was writing about the Hitachi Magic Wand, about how that kind of, like, helped you figure some stuff out sexually after your stroke. And I remember finding it really interesting when you were telling me about how, like, you were even having, like, different types of orgasms than you were used to having.
Yeah, well, so one of the also bummer things that happened is, so because of this specific type of the stroke, which happened in my cerebellum and my medulla, the split down the middle is, like, actually down the middle. Like, you can poke on either side and there's different level of sensation. It's very strange. Like, if you know what a black and white cookie looks like, that's what I am, except for, like, sensation. I don't know which side is which, vanilla or chocolate. You decide. But, so, I wish that I could go back in time and, like, get in an fMRI and do lots of, like, research, because I was one of those people that did have, I mean, who knows what the best term to use at this point is, but, like, at one point we're using the term G-spot and then vaginal and, like, maybe, like, internal clitoral, but, like, I had orgasms that happened from the inside, and that was a nice, fun thing for me. I enjoyed those, and it sort of really informed the sex that I had and the relationship to my body, and, you know, it was just, like, my, you know, all of my sexual life, that was how it was. And then I wish I could go into an fMRI after and be like, something happened, can't feel anymore, what's up? So I can still have clitoral orgasms, which is great, because there are so many nerves that even if you take it down by half in terms of the ones that can feel a fair amount of stimulation, you're still bad and a pretty high average. That's fine. But it has been difficult, even stuff like, you know, the other less, like, immediately erogenous areas of my body can't feel stuff. So, like, I used to be very into, like, I was very responsive on my back. And now, on one side, yes, and on the other side, it's an active kind of, like, gross, creepy sensation. And I've kind of made peace with it, and now that I'm, like, 2 years in, I've started to kind of, like, shift my relationship to it, maybe a little bit, to that sensation, so it's not as unpleasant as it was initially, but it's still kind of neutral. And so, you know, when you feel somebody kissing up your neck, or if there's, like, nipple sensation, or even just, like, somebody caressing your body, there's a side of me that feels really awesome, and a side of me that feels like,
Yeah. Yeah, that's really, it's really tough, just, like, especially because it's been your body for so long, and now it feels, like, entirely different. Like, I'm dealing with, like, a fraction of that because my testosterone is changing my bits, and I'm like, these are not my genitals. Where did they come from? I don't know. And they, like, they experience sensation so differently, and, like, they just look and feel different to, like, my hands and stuff, so it's, it must be really, like, unsettling to just be like, okay, relearning all of the things that my body did.
And I think maybe, like, the most upsetting but, like, broad life lesson aspect of this has been so one of the symptoms, as I said, is that I have, like, major fatigue, and it's just what comes with having a brain injury, and it's not specific to the parts of my brain that were injured, but it feels kind of like I've experienced periods of depression, and it feels kind of like that. And actually, there's been a lot of research that says people who've had strokes in their cerebellum, it actually does impact depression, like, very physiologically. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of thoughts where I'm like, am I depressed because I don't have the life I used to have and had a stroke and that's depressing? Am I depressed because, you know, like, there is like a history of depression in my life? Am I depressed because something happened to my cerebellum and research states that blah, blah, blah? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, it kind of doesn't matter because it's happening anyways. Yeah. And there isn't much I can do about it. And like, I'm lucky that I, after lots and lots of research, found a therapist who was low cost, and I'm able to kind of process this with them to the best of their abilities. But generally speaking, I've done a couple rounds of therapy, and you walk in and you're like, hey, so, I mean, I had just moved in with my partner, my career was going really well, I was finally, like, my burlesque is really taking off, my partner is a musician and I sing, and like, we were doing open mics together, and I just had this wonderful life that was like abruptly taken away. I'm sad. Let's work on that. And they're like, that is sad. Yeah. That's real sad, guy. And I'm like, And then we kind of sit there for a while. But at least the person I have right now is just very like, let's just talk. And we kind of get into the minutia. But long story short, the thing that's kind of the depressing life lesson is that because I'm so tired, because it takes so much more out of me, I can just get by on, like, the work I'm doing. I went back to school, which is an awesome thing, but obviously takes a certain amount of energy. Trying to vaguely, like, keep my house in order. My partner at this point does the vast lion's share of all things, which is amazing. But I don't have time to be, like, whether it's, like, I should learn how to sing with my new voice and, like, embrace some Joanna Newsom-y thing. Or, like, I should rework my burlesque acts and get back into that. Or, like, I should learn how to feel sexy again. Or mm-hmm. I should learn how to do some of the sexual things I used to do or feel more confident in that area. Or, like, I should write. Or I should work on these new projects I have ideas for. It's the constant frustration of having been not a type A person, but a very, like, organized, passionate person who had a lot of ideas and, like, executed a good portion of them, to, like, I have a to-do list a mile long, and I'm like, meh. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if I may say so, like, you feel that way, and that's totally valid, but, like, from an outsider perspective, I find you so amazing. Like, I think you're just inspirational. I don't mean to say that in, like, a cheesy way, but, like, honestly, like, even stroke stuff aside, I also find you, like, very inspirational, because I feel like you're just, like, always doing stuff, and every time I hear about you doing a new thing, I'm like, oh, I wouldn't have thought of that, but that's also, like, weirdly perfect.
Well, yeah. I feel that same way about both of you, and I think there are lots of people in the sex positive community that are doing really interesting things, and I think maybe, like, a certain percent of it is in me, but also a certain percent of it is, like, knowing how many things I had coming down the pipe, and how I kind of, like, stopped all those, pulled back on a few things, and yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm. It's like existential dread exists for everybody, but it's kind of acute when it's like, hey, remember all those things you were working towards despite that? No. You don't get to have those anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and like, not to say like life is suffering, because that's a messed up thing to say on a podcast, but everybody has, I know, I warned you that this might become depressing. But everybody has their stuff, and it's both not healthy to minimize your pain because somebody's suffering worse, but it's also helpful to sometimes look at life and just say, you know, if it wasn't this, it would be something else, and if it wouldn't be now, it would be later. And there are other things that, although I was always really scared of strokes, there was a scary violin music thing that played where the violin music got like all minor key and slow.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah,
it was to explain the different kinds of stroke symptoms. And I remember being really, like, scared of that. And then I remember, like, as I got older, being like, man, I think a stroke would be, like, the worst thing. So, of course.
So what we're saying is your worst fear is coming for you. Don't worry.
Don't worry. It probably isn't. This was statistically fairly rare. But it's nice. One thing I do now is I have a lot of, I'm in a lot of, like, stroke support groups on Facebook, and some of them are young focused, and actually one of them is focused on sexuality.
Oh, cool.
And granted, it's a lot of people who are like, ha ha ha, stroke jokes, but my junk still works. So, but, like, once in a blue moon, somebody will post something actually interesting. And so we talked about Natalie Rose. Natalie Rose, who works as an occupational therapist and is doing a PhD and kind of focuses specifically around disability and sexuality and relationships. She came to my bedside when I was in rehab and brought me an audio copy, because I also couldn't read at the time. My eyesight's been kind of impacted. An audio copy of The Ultimate Guide to Sex and Disability, which is great. Highly recommend. Also written by Torontonians, because of course. And we kind of started talking about my experience in rehab, because my experience in the hospital was really like, don't die. And I don't know what was going on with my oxygen, but for a while that was an indicated possibility. And then it stabilized, and then it was like, okay, go to rehab. And that's where you learn how to, like, you know, get back to your baseline to the best of your ability. And that often means, like, physiotherapy for standing and walking, and occupational therapy for they don't really tell you. And occupational therapy, I thought, was like hands and stuff, like doing things. And in a sense, yes, but it's doing and returning to any sort of occupation you find valid, which is not just occupation in terms of job, but like things that occupy your life. And sexuality is actually one of the only things that technically can bring you, I can't remember what the criteria are, but they're three criteria, and it's like bringing you sort of like autonomy and like self-confidence, potentially being a career, and I cannot remember what the other one is, but yes. And so I did not have the best experience with my sexuality in rehab because it was not acknowledged at any point ever. And I was like, obviously, like, I talked to various people, and they were like, what do you do? And I was like, oh, you know, at that time I worked in feminist porn, so I was like, yeah, I, like, I'm the vice president of this company, and I do this, and blah, blah, blah. So they were aware of that. They were aware that I did sex education. They were aware that my first goal was to be out to do, like, have an evening pass to do Tell Me Something Good, which I told them was my sexuality storytelling night. And they knew also, not that it should ever come to this, but they knew that I lived with my romantic partner, and that through a lot of other discussion of sex, theoretically, I was having sex with my partner. Or at the very least, that was like a valid possibility that they could maybe engage me in. And at no point ever did that happen. They actually had something that was kind of like the wall body massager, W-A-H-L, to try to get, I don't know, it's not a thing, but they were trying to like put it on the side of my body that's affected to see like kind of how the vibrations would maybe bring it back. Who knows? And at one point, my occupational therapist was like, do you think you could get anything like this? And I was like, girl, I have a Hitachi. It's fine.
Do you think I could get? I have 17.
I know. I was like just in my closet, there's like an entire area with things like this, but sure. So it was just a not great experience. And Natalie and I, a little bit while I was in rehab, but mostly kind of after, talked about it, and then we recorded a thing, and she is doing her PhD, so needs to publish stuff, and we wound up writing something that's very, very vulnerable, and it's just, like, about my sex life, and about my kind of sexuality and my body, and my experience in rehab, and just in general, the erasure of sexuality in occupational therapy, and how there are lots of fairly workable ways around it. And we actually had a lot of pushback initially with it because people were like, sexuality is really important, but can we censor all of these words? That made it like a very short, sometimes actually nonsensical. I remember reading it and I was like, so without the word, I think I used the word missionary. This doesn't explain at all what's going on or why, like, the position would be better or worse for somebody with, like, a neck injury or, you know, dizziness or difficulty with, you know, there was no colloquialisms. It wasn't gross. It was just, like, it was just what it was.
So basically science was doing that thing where they're like, of course sex is important, but like, could you just but not like, talk about it?
I love your article on sex, and I'd love to publish it, but without the sex.
Yeah.
Then I don't know what it's about. And one of the biggest issues was actually that I discussed not even in like great detail, but like how anal sex could be impacted when you only have one side of your... I wasn't even like, anal sex is impacted for me. It was just like, in general, if you can't feel half of your body, that includes internally, and so it's harder to know if there's injuries occurring, it's harder to know what your muscles are doing, and it was said that this could be alienating for occupational therapists who had issues with gay sex.
And they should like, maybe not be working in
also,
that
field. And I was like, also, was everyone say, has okay butts. Yeah. Everyone. So it was like, right, that happened, but we did finally find a publisher, and it's the American Journal of Occupational Therapy. So awesome. That's like nice. A big deal. And frankly, we just like went to a bigger publication and we're like, what's up? So that's coming out, I think, in early 2018. And it's weird to have my name on an academic paper where I went back to school and I'm studying psychology, and part of me wants to be like, look, I'm published. And then another part of me wants to be like, but maybe don't read it. It's like, I don't know if I necessarily want my professor is reading about like my intimate sex life.
Yeah, yikes. I know that life.
Well, yes, of course. Like, if there is a choir, I am preaching to it, of course. But yeah, I think it's like the legitimacy of, and it's also the legitimacy of my experience as kind of like storytelling as qualitative, not quantitative, in a space that is, I mean, occupational therapy maybe slightly less so, but psychology for sure, they have a complicated relationship to autobiographical things, and they have a complicated relationship to things that are not empirical. I mean, they are because it's just one person, and so technically it's empirical to my experience, but like, you can't replicate this study because I'm the only me.
So one of the things you've been doing since your stroke that I think is really cool is you are a queer matchmaker. We were talking about this before you came over, and we were like, we want to ask about matchmaking, but like, kind of the main thing that we're both curious about is like, how do you, because like, it's not like an algorithm on OkCupid where it kind of like matches people mathematically. It's like you're getting to know real people IRL. What kinds of things do you look for to decide who's gonna match well with who?
Well, so there are, it's not like an algorithm, but there are a lot of like initial things, because the beauty of the LGBTQ community is that everybody's different, and everybody has different interests and different opinions and different feelings and desires, and the total downer when it comes to matchmaking is that everybody's different, and sometimes you'll meet all of these amazing people. Like, I'll go for a week of meetings and I'll be like, I met all these amazing new people who would not match well together at all, because that person's not into that person's gender, that person's a top, and that person's a top as well, and that's a deal breaker. And like, you know, those people will be a great match, except they're actually like 25 years apart and they both are way out of each other's age ranges. And so we get a lot of those things out of the way, whether it's like, want to date somebody who has kids or wants to have more kids, poly, obviously, like, we talk a little bit about sexuality. I always say, especially when people identify as kinky, like, please, like, tell me as much as you want, and I will look for traits of open-mindedness, of, like, enthusiasm about sex, but I can't necessarily be like, okay, genderqueer daddy wants to find like somebody between the ages of like 32 and 40 who like also loves Grey's Anatomy and like lives downtown. Unfortunately, he's allergic to cats, so blah, blah, blah. You know, like, I can't necessarily go that deep because it's already quite deep. But I think what I look for, aside from the obvious like deal breaker stuff that is totally fair, is vibes. And I know that's so cheesy, but there is this sense that I get from people. And sometimes it's even like, I, you know, we do little interviews, and then we like little written interviews, and then we do an in-person meeting for a little, like an hour and a half. I look for people who maybe, even if they didn't write it down, keep coming back to words over and over again. We ask a lot of questions about like traits that they're most looking for in a partner, examples of like relationships they've had, what they've learned from it, and maybe what they would most like to take from it for the future. And it's a mix of like setting up the parameters, filling it in with things like, oh, they both really like hiking, they both want a family, they both, you know, want to retire out of the city. And then I look for things like, this person really values openness. Mm-hmm. So did this person. And when I interview them sort of more in depth about what that openness means, they both mean sort of like generosity of spirit. They're looking, and sometimes like experiences from their exes that were negative, it seems like this type of person would be really healing for that. And sometimes it really is just like, I honestly get the goosebumps of like, oh, this person would match really well with this person. And it's not like a spidey sense, but it's being thoughtful, listening in conversations, being kind of attuned to the things they're saying and also the things they're not saying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So you do this matchmaking for friend of a friend matchmaking, and you're the queer plus matchmaker there,
yeah,
as opposed to someone who focuses mostly on straight folks. So I'm curious, like, what are the differences? Like, what are queer people looking for that's, like, different from what straight people might be looking for, aside from the obvious gender and sex things?
Yeah. The answer universally is that sometimes nothing, sometimes lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
And I also think that as I've gotten more into the matchmaking experience, I'm coming up on a year now, I've become aware of also the amount of, like, straight people who would greatly benefit from just kind of what I bring and what I think friend of a friend brings in general, but that is not traditional to matchmaking, which is like a pretty open-ended idea of relationships, of what we consider normatively attractive, both like physically and in terms of like personal characteristics. And also just like even flexibility within different definitions. If somebody is poly, but they're looking for somebody to have a kid with versus like and including that among other options,
mm-hmm,
has been really nice. So I don't know. I mean, there are certain things like I like to talk more about politics, specifically queer politics.
Mm-hmm.
I like to talk about, you know, like how out are you in your life? How out would you like a partner to be? Are you like pride is a party, pride is a protest, or pride is a headache and I like to leave the city, I don't like standing, you know, pride used to be great but now I feel old and over it. So sometimes we have fun talks about that, and we talk about like level of political engagement or like relationship to the queer community. Are you somebody who likes to be in queer spaces? What do those queer spaces look like? Why do you go there? And then we wind up talking a lot about kind of family and experiences with coming out or why they didn't come out, discussions of disclosure around friends and careers. And those are things that I think don't enter in as much when you're talking to straight people. I think naively, I thought that perhaps it would be people would be all 100% awesome all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they really are amazing, wonderful people. But you still do get into the discussion of physical stuff, because obviously physical stuff is important to dating to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm.
But that sometimes you get backed into a corner of like trying to help people examine why they're into certain things. And I think that's also very valuable for straight folks.
Mm-hmm.
I think in general, mm-hmm, like, matching is my primary motive, but my secondary motive within that is to kind of help people to... I don't want to, like, push anybody to date somebody they don't want to date. I don't want to push anybody to try to be into something they're not, but to help people move their age expectations a little bit, to be more open in terms of physical appearance. A big one for me is height.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of the times I'll have somebody who's like really into cis women but wanting a partner who's like 5'10" or taller, and I'm like, not that I'm all about stats all the time, but I'm kind of like, so here's the percentage of people who fit into that demographic. And it's the same, like, it's a very prevalent thing with straight folks when they're talking about men. And it's true that there are very, very, very few people once you're looking over 6 feet. And maybe that person isn't into you. Maybe that person is, like, super out of your age range. Maybe that person sucks. And maybe your soulmate is 5'7", and you're just going to have to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
Soulmate, of course, is, like, a nebulous term. But, like, a wonderful, wonderful match with you in every single other regards is a couple inches shorter than you were expecting. I'm kind of, like, deal with it. I'm also a short person. person married to a short person. Mm-hmm. And it both bums me out so much that he was probably passed over. And also it makes me super psyched because good for me.
Yeah.
I win this round. I get the husband. He's the best. But it's true. There are so many wonderful people who, for whatever sort of like at least somewhat cosmetic reason, are passed over when they might be perfect. So I just like to kind of, I like to think of myself as a queer love fairy, and mm-hmm. that's not just like bing, 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 making people fall in love. I don't have those powers, but helping people to open up to those who might be a great match for them, but don't fit into the sort of okay cupidized like pizza ordering format that they're used to of like, you must be this tall to ride, mm-hmm. athletic or average, you know, like, and a lot of it's also racism, so
yeah.
I am okay being the person who's like, so how does that make you feel when you say that?
Consider that you're racist.
Yeah, and like, I don't use those terms because obviously these people are coming to me being open, and sometimes they, like, you know, it's unexamined, or just, like, people assume, like, that's just who I'm attracted to, and I have a lot of complicated feelings about that's just who I'm attracted to,
mm-hmm.
Because I think people don't always think about where that comes from, or how it can really be changed. Like, I don't think of myself as being a person who has a type, because I have dated and hooked up with so many lovely people who are so radically different.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I find, like, if I really, really am into somebody, all of a sudden I'll be noticing other folks who look like them. And then all of a sudden it will become like, oh, my favorite celebrity does look like them now. Or, mm-hmm. like, you know, that's sort of a nice thing that happens. There are some faces being made across the table.
Yeah, well, I think we both do that. But, like, yeah. This is what actually interests me so much about the human matchmaking process, as in the matchmaker is a human and not a robot on OkCupid,
yes.
is that there is an element of, like, seeing something in someone that an algorithm can't see. So, like,
exactly.
when you were talking about height, I was thinking about how my boyfriend is 5 inches shorter than me, and, like, height isn't super important to me, but if you had just sort of described him to me, I don't know that I would have been like, yeah, for sure, need to date that person. And then as I got to know him, I was like, oh, actually, you are magical and wonderful, and I feel a lot of things. And it was just like, it was one of those things that I don't think an algorithm would be able to... Well, I'm saying that, and actually we're a 97% match on OkCupid, but that's neither here
that's
nor there.
That's true. But if you set, and I think a lot of people do, you can set things, especially if you're on A-list, mm-hmm. As like... deal breakers. And if you had said that your deal breaker was like, must be this tall to ride, then you would not have seen
mm-hmm.
a message. It'd been in your filtered box, and maybe you don't check that. But also it's like, if you're out with your friends and you know, are introduced to their friend and they're short, and you automatically think like, eh, not for me.
Mm-hmm.
Or you're at, you know, a dance club, or you join a choir or whatever, and you have this mentality of someone being short. It's just an extra hoop to jump through that sometimes you will not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious, we were talking a little bit about OkCupid, and I think part of it too is OkCupid is very self-reported versus what other people actually see in you. But I'm curious, like, if you see a difference in the type of people that come to a matchmaking person instead of going on OkCupid.
Well, so it's not universal, and I don't want to say that price is the barrier, because I do sometimes do sliding scale or like reductions, and even oral, like, people will, if we've given away like a free membership to a charity and they do an auction and then someone gets it, it's that, whether it's the price barrier a little bit, it's not too expensive, whether it's the price barrier or whether it's the fact that you're meeting up with another physical human who's looking you in the eye and saying like, don't be a jerk to these people. You're investing something in it. You're, you know, filling it out. You're going to this meeting. You're having a discussion. People cry, or people, you know, get really sort of, you know, they wade into the darkness of themselves sometimes, or they examine, you know, things that they wouldn't examine being asked questions on OkCupid, mm-hmm. filling out a form. And there's a little bit more seriousness that goes into that. And it's not, to be clear, like escalator model of relationship seriousness, like, I want to get married and have kids. It can be that, but it's not necessarily. But it's the seriousness of being committed to a process, going into it as openly as you can because you genuinely want it to work.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a lark. to go meet up with a matchmaker and have them ask you a lot of questions about your life. It's something that is sort of more of a process. And so at the very least, people are respectful to those they're matched with. They met up. People give me feedback after, which I really appreciate, which is just like, you know, maybe there was no chemistry, or they're dating and they're off the market now, or, you know, I realize maybe don't set me up with somebody who is like this way or has this in their life. But they're respectful of the process and the people involved in the process. Whereas on online dating, like OkCupid, but especially apps sometimes, flakiness, being very just like disrespectful to the other person happens. Yep. And there are times...
I mean, even myself, I'll find myself like on Tinder just like because I'm bored and it's a game, and then I'm like, oh, these are all actual people.
They're human.
And I'm just like getting a match and being like, I win! Moving on. And then they message me and I'm like, whoa, shit, you want to talk? I don't think, shit, I didn't expect this part.
But that's why there are, like, and I really say this, that's why there are dating sims. Like, I noticed you're into the,
Dream Daddy is so good.
And that's great, because your Dream Daddy is never going to, like, ask you to go.
My Dream Daddy ghosted me.
See, and that's why maybe you should have gone to a Dream Daddy matchmaker. So at the very least, if someone ghosted you, I would send like a gentle follow up message, being like, "Hey, I saw that you were hanging out with
Beth." Sassy anti ghost person.
Kind of.
That's amazing.
Not like so. It's never aggressive, and it's never awful, but I do check up with people after their dates.
So what you're saying is that if I have a matchmaker and they try to ghost me, I can call Ghostbusters.
Yes.
And he will follow up and be like, bro.
I guess I am, in a way, a Ghostbuster. And it's never, like, I mean, there are sort of a lot of reasons for ghosting. Mm-hmm. And I'm even fine at times being like, the ghost between, say. You know, if somebody has, you know, if they've had, like, sort of an anxiety episode, or like something really serious in their life has happened, or even if they're just like, I actually am not ready for this, I can be like, hey, just to the other person, like, you're not making up your feelings that you had. Like, they had a nice time, but, you know, X, Y, Z, and I'm, you know, as private as they want it to be. But I just think in general, it's good for me to get feedback, because it helps me create better matches in the future. But also, everybody who's involved in matchmaking deserves a respectful experience, and if they don't have that, I like to at least kind of work it out. And this hasn't really happened, but I like to think this is what would happen. I don't mind being like I'm as hands-on or as hands-off. I don't like to clog people's inboxes unless I have a match for them, because there's nothing worse than when you get like, and it's the same when you get like a message from OkCupid in your email and it's supposed to be like a match, but it's really just like, these hot singles are in your area, and you're like, shut up, I know. I don't want to be like, hey, just checking in, buddy, how are you doing? But people who, whether they message me to say like, these things in my life have kind of changed, this might impact matching, or whether they're like, hey, I don't know if I, you know, explain myself as clearly as I'd like, or like, I went on this date and I'm not sure how I feel, or like, what should I write in the first message to this person? I'm happy to, within reason, kind of like confer. Also, because I've genuinely liked everyone I've met. So I want them to have a good time. I want them to feel comfortable. And if there's a barrier that I can help with that isn't like a huge ask of my labor, I'm super happy to be involved.
Thank you so much for being on our show, Claire. Do you want to tell folks where they can find you online and what you're up to next?
Yeah, so ClaireAH.com is kind of where I am in general for everything. The radio show, which Kate is also on, is sexcityradio.com. You can find more about Tell Me Something Good online at tmsgstories.com. That has info about the live show and the podcast, which is been on hiatus. There's nothing like starting a podcast and then having a stroke. And then, like, my co-host Samantha also is having migraine issues. I got married. She just moved. So it's like a whole thing. But we're working on it. And then friendofafriendmatchmaking.com is the matchmaking service, if you're interested. Is that all I do? for now, that's all I do. But check out ClaireAH.com or like I'm Claire on Twitter, which is ClaireA5Hs. So that's where I'll kind of be talking about some new projects that I have in the works.
Okay, cool. My name is Kate Sloan. You can find my sex blog at girlyjuice.net and the rest of my writing at katewritesaboutsex.com. You can also follow me on Twitter or Instagram at girly_juice. Where is your stuff at?
I'm Bex. You can find my writing at bextalksex.com. You can also follow me at bextalksex on Twitter and Instagram. Together we're the Dildorks. You can follow us at the Dildorks on Twitter and Instagram. This week we want you to tweet at us the content notes for your favorite sex story, and we'll see if we can piece together what happened.
Can I tell you what mine were last night? And you can piece this together. I think mine last night was something like sex toys, spanking, bad jokes, and working retail.
Ooh. Mine was really big butt plugs, long distance DS, and vaguely romantic butt play, and mac and cheese donuts. If you want to continue to support us, you can find us on your favorite podcast app and give us a review and a rating. Makes it easier for other people to find us, and you make us smile. You can also go to patreon.com/thedildarks, throw a few books.
You could throw a few books our way. I won't be mad about that. That would hurt, though.
You could also throw a few bucks our way. I'm going to say that one more time. Go to patreon.com/thedildorks, throw a few bucks our way. Helps us get to cool events like Tell Me Something Good. It's how I got up here. I got my bus ticket to Toronto, and we've recorded a bunch of podcasts while I was up here. Mm-hmm.
It's not expensive for me to get there. I just have to pay $3.25 to get on the streetcar, but still helpful.
I need a megabus.
Yeah. Thank you so much to Protodome for letting us use his song I Want You in My Bedroom as our theme song. His music is at protodome.bandcamp.com. And thank you, as always, to Amy Gardner at starboots_ on Twitter for doing our art. Until next time, folks, get out there and live your sexy, dorky life. Bye!
And, like, hand. I don't know how responsive the snowball is. Like, hands, pinky, jewelry.
This stuff is not good.
I try to keep my hands here.
Yeah. I mean, it's okay, because I edit and I kind of know how to fix that
stuff. But I know it's super annoying, and you'll be talking, and I'll be like...
Yeah.
So I will try to keep them here.
I jingle.
I'm a hand talker. Okay, every time I listen to the podcast, I'm like, where's my cat? Like, every single time. Yeah.
It's a pup, and they're inside the podcast.
It's me. I'm sorry. Also, because when I'm thinking, I do this a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So.
Even on I was listening to the latest episode on the way here, and I was like...
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes a lot more sense.
It greatly annoys me as an audio engineer, but as a kinkster, I'm like, aw.
It's sweet. You know, it's just the ambient noise that allegedly, like, it really brings you into the space.
That's what you would hear if you were talking to me.
It's the soundscape.
Lots of jingling. Yeah.